Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of The Week That Really Was with John McGurk and Sarah Ryan. It is the week ending the 26th of April, 2024. We are recording this a little bit earlier than usual on a Thursday afternoon. I want to thank everybody before we begin for the unprecedented success of last week's episode. It was our most listened to episode ever with Helen Joyce. It was in the tens of thousands of listeners, 16,000 of you alone tuning in on YouTube. We're blown away by that. I said at the beginning of that episode that I was joined last week by two amazing women, Sarah Ryan and Helen Joyce. Well, this week I am joined by one amazing woman, Sarah Ryan, and an enormous elephant in the corner of the room. Sarah, why don't we talk about the elephant in the corner of the room?
Let's discuss the elephant in the room, John. Where shall we begin?
Well, I was tuning in the other day to the campaign launch of Niall Boylan, who is running for the European Parliament in Dublin. And there I saw, to his left, sitting at the top table, to his right, to my left, looking at it, the most astonishingly beautiful woman in the world. And I thought to myself, I know that face.
Yeah.
I should say the second most astonishingly beautiful woman in the world, obviously.
Or good save.
And then it was confirmed to me it was, in fact, you. You were sitting at the top table. What's that all that about?
So what that's about is that I am managing a campaign for Niall Boylan to run for Europe. I'm going to be completely transparent about that. Niall is a friend of mine, and he's kind of dabbled with the idea of getting involved in politics for a long time. And because I have experience and obviously my dad was an MEP and I've been involved in those campaigns before, he asked me to manage it. And I feel, I suppose, you know, I'm not interested in getting involved in politics myself, but I do love campaigning. And I think that we're at a kind of an interesting moment in our political story in Ireland. And I don't want to sit it out completely. So I agreed and I'm going to manage that campaign. It's launched this past week, a bit earlier than we wanted. It leaked out on Monday when we were planning on launching on Tuesday. But yeah, I think he's a really good candidate. I think it's time to shake up that election. I think there's a lot of really boring incumbents and, you know, nothing interesting about that race, frankly, until this week.
Well, I mean, I have a couple of questions. I mean, the first is the obvious one, which is, like, you know, you're obviously a wife and a mother to three young children. I mean, what's going to happen to poor Keith? Running a campaign for the next 6 weeks, I mean, the man might starve. Who's going to make the dinner? I mean, I'm joking because it's an immense amount of work is what I'm saying. What you've taken on is an immense amount of work. Like, you know, are you...
Yeah, I mean, look, let's cast our minds back. You're a very good friend of mine, so you know me very well. When I had two children and was pregnant with my third child, I attended the King's Inns to become a barrister, which is an unbelievably intense year of you know, in-person studying and attending the King's Inns every day. So much so that I nearly made it, but I went into labour in the drafting exam in the King's Inns and had my daughter in the middle of those exams. So, and then had a newborn, had a baby and was back a week later to finish those exams. So, and then did the rest of them over the course of that summer with a newborn and two children. So like, I'm pretty good multitasker. You'd be amazed at what I can do. I think most women are like that, to be honest, because they just have to be. It is a lot of work, but at the same time, I just feel like we talk a lot and we live in these different bubbles and people are really frustrated and there's all these different conversations that you could be having, but actually getting involved in it at that level is just something I really want to do at this point.
Yeah, I just want to say, by the way, that I can already see the emails coming in pointing out that I would never have asked that question to a man. That was the whole point. It was a joke. That's why I asked that question.
Because obviously that's the way I took it.
I mean, a man would never be asked that question. There is obviously another issue here, which is a bit of housekeeping, which is how are we going to deal with this on this podcast, which is obviously an important issue for our listeners, because there will be many people out there, Sarah, who might be well disposed towards Niall Boylan, who might not be well disposed towards Niall Boylan, who might be backing other candidates. I already had emails from people who support Aintu wondering when this news came out how we would deal with that. The answer to those people is that I am not running anybody's campaign, and while Sarah is not only my colleague but a very dear friend, you know, I I'm not going to be in any way biased in favor of Niall Boylan's campaign or indeed against it. And if Sarah tries to use this platform to proselytize on behalf of her candidate, I will gently call her out on it. I think a lot of you as listeners have grown to know Sarah and like her and respect her, and you know she's somebody who calls it like it is. So I hope as a sort of community between ourselves as the hosts and you as the listeners, we can work this one out and work through it. Because the other alternative was to bench Sarah for the next 6 weeks. I don't strictly feel like doing that. And I don't think a lot of listeners on balance would want me to do that. So we're not going to do it. Let's talk.
Also, though, the people who listen to this podcast should be very aware that, like, I mean, apart from Niall, Aintu would be, I'm a huge fan of Aintu and Padraig Tobin, and they Aintu have the least to worry about when it comes to me criticising any candidates, as I'm sure the listeners are well aware.
Yes, the Labour Party, on the other hand, might well have complaints. But you know what? We're not BAI regulated. This is a podcast. It's not going out on the airwaves. So we have a little bit more, freedom.
But the point is that I'm not hiding that I'm running a campaign and being open about it. So everything I say, and like, it's not like we're going to discuss the European elections on every podcast, but like everything I say is now openly seen through the prism of the fact that I'm running that campaign. If I have a prediction about that election or what might happen, obviously it's biased, but at the same time, it's not irrelevant either. Do you know what I mean? But now that people know, they know. So they can take what I say with that in mind.
Well, you know what we can do? Because there are people who are going to be listening to this who are obviously either involved in campaigns themselves or who are thinking of running for the local elections. I think the nominations are still open for another 2 or 3 days after this podcast goes out, if they're thinking of getting in the race. Like, what is, you know, in broad terms, without revealing any specific secrets of the particular campaign you're involved in, what's it involve? Like, what's the main objective? Is it writing tweets for the candidate? Is it sending out press releases? Like, what's your job?
No, my job is to manage a bunch of people, including the candidate, deciding what, you know, I mean, Niall chooses his own message. I mean, I don't tell him what to say, if you know what I mean. So he has the issues that he wants to campaign on. My job is logistics, it's background stuff. I order posters, I organize events, I push volunteers in one direction if he's attending an event. You know, it's an administrative role. You know, it's a busy role. You sit down and you talk about what press release, what we're going to talk about, or what he wants to talk about this week, where he's going to be, what he's going to be saying. But it's administrative predominantly. Obviously I have a political experience and I'll have a nose for things that, you know, Niall doesn't. He's never run before, and I'll say, oh, maybe you should stay away from that, maybe you should steer more in this direction or whatever it might be. But ultimately it's administrative and strategic.
Many listeners will know that I obviously was heavily involved in various referendum campaigns and a couple of Dáil election campaigns, never European election campaigns. But I've always found that the job is entirely a logistics job. I mean, it is the purpose of a campaign is to make sure that every voter knows that you're running and why you're running.
Yeah.
And the you know, that involves lots of leaflets, lots of posters, putting posters up, taking them down, getting the organizing canvases, all that sort of stuff. And lots of people kind of think it's a glamorous job, but you and I know it's not at all a glamorous job. So good luck to you with that. Anyway, let's move on to talk about what we normally talk about on this program, which is Irish politics. And for me, the highlight of the week had to be the Oireachtas Committee hearing with the Minister for Justice.
Highlight is an interesting choice of words, but go on.
And there was this exchange which we posted on Gripped social media channels. It has, as of the time we're recording this podcast, has been viewed like 650,000 times. Which is, you know, a bigger audience than the Late Late Show can boast, and probably still is, even if you think that, you know, some of those views are multiple views or whatever. And it's this exchange between Michael McNamara, who also announced that he's running for the European elections, albeit in Ireland South this week, and Helen McEntee, in which he puts a series of questions to her about the administrative functioning of the immigration system, and she just can't answer. And it is one of the most appalling examples of ministerial ineptitude I can recall in years. if not ever. I was trying to think during the week, has there ever been a minister who's had as bad a moment as that in the Oireachtas committee? And I can't think of one. Can you?
No. Like, it was bad. Like, it was very toe-curling, very uncomfortable to watch. Like, I don't know Helen McAtee at all. I've never met her. I felt sorry for her. And I think that when you start to feel sorry for somebody, it's pretty bad. It felt like somebody who hasn't got a clue what's going on. And I think that the implications for that are massive, particularly for Simon Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a person who chose to stand their ground to keep her in a position that this interview demonstrated she does not have her arms around her brief by any stretch of the imagination. It's a worry that she doesn't have the facts and figures to hand that she needs. But what did she think she was going into?
At around about the time we're recording this podcast, Ben should be at a press conference with the Taoiseach around about now as we're recording. And, you know, he and I were talking this morning and saying, you know, are there any interesting questions to ask? And we agreed that he would basically ask Simon Harris the exact same questions that Michael McNamara put to the Minister for Justice. And see, can he answer? Because I want to know if this is is this an issue with a specific minister not being on top of her brief and Simon Harris actually being on top of the brief, which would arguably be terrible? Or is it a matter of wholesale government ineptitude where he doesn't know either? Because the specific question was this. It was obviously under the present operating of the European immigration system. If a person has come here, say, from Germany, and they've already applied for asylum in Germany, and then they apply for asylum here, the Irish government can say to the German government, you have to take this person back because they applied with you first. And you have to process them there. And so in the last year, there were, I think from memory, 178 such cases where the other government, let's say, for example, the German government, said to Dublin, yeah, you're right, that guy is ours, send him back to us. And the Irish government, of those 178 cases where people had actually agreed, or the other government had agreed to take somebody back, the Irish government had nonetheless sent back only three. These weren't cases where there was any matter of deportation or anything like that. It was simply, you don't belong in Ireland, you belong in Germany, or you belong in France, or you belong in Italy, or somewhere else. That's where you should be applying for asylum. And Spain, France, or Germany has agreed to take you. And yet and all, we only sent three people. Like, that's astonishing. That at a time when we have no bed space for the people coming in here who we are obliged to process under existing law, or the government says we're obliged to process under existing law, we're not even doing the basics correct. I mean, that is just, it's mind-boggling, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, but are you shocked?
I actually am a little bit shocked. I'll tell you why I'm a little bit shocked, because it is so clearly in their political interest to do that small basic thing right. I mean, even if they're not, if, you know, the numbers are going to increase this year because their policy remains that anyone who comes here has to be processed. You know, whatever, we can't put people. She also said at the committee meeting that the Irish public did not want there to be detention centres or anything like that where people were waited before they were processed, before they were allowed access onto Irish soil. I'm not sure she's right about that, by the way, but that's what she said. So their policy is we have to take everybody and process them. But they know what's causing them political problems. And here's a very small, like, pressure release valve on the system that can reduce some of those numbers without, I mean, you're not sending somebody back to Sudan. You're not sending somebody, you're not being a big meanie like they fear being and sending somebody to outer Micronesia where, you know, the tribals might eat them or something. This is sending people to Germany or Bulgaria or Belgium where there's no human rights abuses and those countries have agreed to take them and we can't manage that. So, yeah, I am shocked.
But you're talking about a government, like, for example, like they don't take the easy, they don't take small wins like that. They don't fix small problems because ultimately they're paralyzed by a fear that doing things in any way might make them look a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So like Simon Harris, for example, like the easiest thing in the world for him to do was to just bin the hate speech bill the minute he got in. And he's doubling down on it because he doesn't think, because, you know, on some level, it seems like he thinks that it's like a win for the far right or something. And so he doubles down on it. This, like, you know, actually implementing the correct enforcing the deportation of these people, like every other country in Europe is doing, is the obvious thing to do, but they don't do it because on some level it feels like they think that that might make them look, you know, a certain way. It's they're paralyzed that the optics of things make them look a certain way, so they don't do anything.
Yeah. But like, is it more than that? Is it also administrative incompetence? Because I had a conversation with somebody this week who works in the security space, in the private sector, and had been approached for a job in the Department of Justice, not a political job, not working for a politician, pure administrative role in the Department of Justice at quite a high level. And this person told me he was seriously considering it because he's very interested in the area, basically. And he'd asked around and he had been told in no uncertain terms by people he talked to, under no circumstances go to the Department of Justice because, in that person's words, it is a disaster zone. I thought that was telling. So I don't know if it's only the minister, although I think ultimately the minister has to take responsibility because she's the person who is appointed by the civilian population to oversee, this is the point of a minister, to oversee and hold accountable civil servants running the Department of Justice. And that is just one anecdote, but it's not the only example. We also had, since we last did this podcast, we also had the FOI that released to GRIPT, which showed basically that department officials were screaming in the run-up to the last couple of referendums that, you know, these referendums have the potential to cause massive problems. And they were ultimately overruled either by the minister or the attorney general.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems to me to be, it's the new health, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the new health, and it's just being ignored by everybody. I mean, like, I do kind of feel sorry for her because I think that she's over her head. I don't think every single problem that's going on in a department is necessarily the fault of the minister, but the responsibility does lie. That's the way it works. And many's a minister in our history has had to fall on their sword for less and for reasons within their department that weren't necessarily their fault, technically, if you know what I mean. So I think that there's a lot of things going on there, and I think they all lead to one answer. And it's an answer that Simon Harris seems unprepared to engage with.
Well, I don't feel sorry for her. And I'll tell you why I don't feel sorry for her, which is she sought the job. She, and not only did she seek the job, but anyone who followed the coverage of running into the reshuffle will have been left in no doubt that she lobbied incredibly hard to keep the job. There were various articles in the newspapers in the run-in to Simon Harris appointing his ministerial team, which strongly indicated that the Minister for Justice was running a significant campaign to ensure that she would not be moved in the reshuffle. There was a specific reference to perhaps a Fine Gael fundraising, which is her husband is on one of the committees that deals with Fine Gael fundraising, might cause issues within the party and so on and so forth, that appear in the pages of national newspapers. And you and I both know, Sarah, because we've been around long enough, that such stories do not appear in the national newspapers out of thin air. And so I don't feel sorry for her because she wanted this job. She put herself before the people. She sought the office. And I also think that one of the most important qualities in life is humility. I mean, I ran for election once, and I've said publicly that I'm not going to say never, ever, but I'm very disinclined to do it again because I did it once and I realized I don't have that skill set. I don't have that skill set. I mean, to be an effective public representative in Ireland, you need to be able to, you need to be a much more social person, for example, than I am. You need to be.
I don't agree with that, actually.
Well, that was my experience. I felt, having done that once, that the experience, which I didn't really enjoy the experience, not that it was particularly bad, but I felt that there was a mismatch between what I'm good at and what running for election required me to be good at.
But I think running for election requires different things depending on who you are, like what your, let's say, your suite of beliefs is and what the climate is at the time. And I think that over in my 40 years, I'd say I've been, you know, involved in some way. I mean, I've been involved in some way in politics since I'm a child. And I think that one thing I've observed over the years is who the candidate is, their ability, their skill set, as you say, and their whether or not they get elected are not as correlated as you might think. And events and luck and timing play a massive amount of time, or play a massive amount of part in whether or not people get elected. As I've said before, you know, Sinn Féin people on their big good day were getting elected while they're on holidays. Mm-hmm. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, just not even kind of, you know, people get elected who barely have to canvass. I mean, do you remember when George Lee ran in a by-election, and I remember just fascinatedly watching it? You know, hundreds of people came out, few leaflets, bit of hand, you know, whatever, and elected, topped the poll, 50% of the vote, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And other people will be out there knocking on doors, one or two people with them, for years. You know, it's just not the same kind of thing. It depends on a lot of different variables. But I take your point. You don't want to do it again. You don't like it. I'm not really a big fan of canvassing myself door to door. Over the years, I've developed a kind of a deep suspicion, particularly in Dublin, that with the amount of people who open the door, the amount of distractions in people's lives, the busyness of people's lives, their phone, whatever, if they open the door, take the leaflet off you and close the door and walk back in, they forget it even happened.
Yeah. But my broader point here is you have to have the self-awareness to know when you're no good at something. Or maybe you're wrong. Maybe you are good at it and you don't think you're good at it, but you have to have confidence in your own abilities and know that you're on top of your brief and know that you're, like, especially when you're serving the public in a role like that. I don't know the woman. I have never met her, but unless she is the least self-aware human being in the whole world, she has to know, particularly in light of that committee performance the other day, that she is not on top of her brief.
I mean, I felt sorry for her, John. I mean, I felt sorry for her in watching that. It was like a mauling. It was like watching, you know, it was like an episode of The Simpsons where they're like, stop kicking it, it's already dead. Like, you know, it was like, make it end. It's horrifying to watch because you're just cringing.
Yeah. So, or somebody said to me during the week, the lions and the Christians in ancient Rome.
Yeah.
Except he said, I was rooting for the lions.
I mean, I think Michael McNamara is an exceptionally good parliamentarian. And I think he came with his Uber Walia and she didn't. And it was obvious. But it paints a really grim picture of her overall. I'd love to have been a fly on the wall. I'd say she got a call from Simon Harris after that.
I wonder what it's like when Simon Harris is giving out to you, if he does that.
Well, the amount of people who like contacted me after our podcast a couple of weeks ago when you compared him to what's his name from Father Ted?
Owen McGlove.
So people were highly amused. It's probably like getting a dressing down from Owen McGlove.
Yeah. Well, Owen McGlove was a bit of a meanie, as I recall, when the cameras were off. So I mean, I have no idea what Simon. I've always found him pleasant on the few occasions that we've met. So, but he's never had reason to give out to me about letting him down. So I don't know. But I think you're right. If he didn't give her a call after that, he wasn't doing his job, which is to hold the cabinet to account.
The wider point here, though, is that there's like this competence, schmompetence, but like the problems that we have are still there. The problems that we have around, you know, her brief and what's or isn't working vis-a-vis immigration are still there. So, you know, the tents are now, you know, creeping up Mount Street. Nothing's being fixed. Nothing's changing. This problem is getting worse by the day. And so, you know, we can sit around and we can watch videos of her and talk about her competence or not. But what is Simon Harris as the Taoiseach of Ireland's plan for what's happening? The human rights issue that's emerging on Mount Street in Dublin too.
Well, it's probably in Portaloos.
Yeah, brilliant.
I mean, the thing about that is, like, you're basically saying this is now a permanent shanty town.
I know. You know? Yeah.
Like, you know, what's he going to put in next? You know, bring up a burger van, you know, serve food 24/7. I mean, we're basically creating a permanent shanty town in the center of the capital city, which is not unlike something you would see in war-torn Mogadishu, you know? It's extraordinary.
Yeah. And a few weeks ago, we had politicians like Aon and people like that go up and film themselves and all, like, oh, you know, this is a disgrace, whatever. They're all moved away. It was in March because it was St. Patrick's weekend. And, you know, it was this big thing that they were all moved on or whatever. Now it's back. It's worse than ever. And it's just like, no, there's no plan.
What I'm interested in, are there limits on the size of the shanty town? I mean, like, will something be done when it reaches Hollis Street Hospital? I mean, what happens, God forbid, it crosses the canal and actually ventures into, starts colonizing South Dublin? I mean, what happens then? I mean, is it just to grow exponentially?
But also, you know, there's people who live there.
Yes, like, there are. Like, but I mean, who cares about them?
There's people whose homes are there who, you know, before, okay, fine, the Portaloos have solved the, you know, some of the problems that were there before that we won't mention. But like, it's just, it's used as a kind of a political issue to suit the agenda of whoever it is that's talking about, but it's not actually being fixed, you know?
It's more than that, though. I sent Ben down there yesterday. So today's Thursday. We're recording on Thursday. So yesterday, Ben went down to the shanty town to record and interview some of the residents. And he found it very hard to get the residents to talk on camera, which is not, you know, I don't blame them necessarily for that, but he got one guy to talk on camera. And he said to him, why are you in Ireland? How come you're here? And so the guy is originally from the West Bank in Palestine. And when October 7th happened, he had been studying in university in Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, which borders Israel and the West Bank. And then after October the 7th, he felt that it was no longer safe for him to go back to the West Bank, even though the West Bank is not under, you know, is not an active war zone. I know people will say the Israelis are not innocent in the West Bank and so on and so forth, but it's not an active war zone. It's not like Gaza.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he also said that his university costs in Amman in Jordan were too expensive. So he thought he'd come to Ireland and see where they, you know, could he continue his studies here? I mean, the guy basically admitted straight up that he was an economic migrant who's now living in a tent on Mount Street. He also said that by and large, Irish people were very nice, but he was finding it difficult to sleep because of, and these are his words, I'm not saying whether they're true or not, I'm just saying this is his lived experience, as our friends on the left say, because of all of his neighbours in the tents doing drug deals in the middle of the night. So, and that's all on video. I think it'll be, by the time you listen to this, it'll probably have been published.
Take a minute for the appalling conditions that Ireland is putting this man in when he arrives. Like, is that not, should we not be ashamed of ourselves that we're putting somebody onto the street who arrives?
I sympathize with that view, yes. But there's another view too, Sarah, which is this guy was in Jordan. Like, Jordan is a liberal Muslim majority country. It's ruled by a monarch, an Oxford educated monarch. Is English speaking, very liberal regime by the standards of the Middle East. Perfectly safe country. Living standards are high. What's he doing here? Like, you know, why is he living in a tent on Mount Street? Why is there to say, hold on a second, I've listened to your story, which, by the way, if he's telling that story to Ben Scallon on the street, then that's presumably the same story that he's telling to the immigration officials inside the building. Why is there nobody there to say, yeah, sorry, you don't qualify, mate. There's a flight to Amman leaving tomorrow. We put you on it and pay your way. Is that not a fair question?
No, of course it's a fair question. I'm just saying that it's both. Like, there's two issues. I think that people, you know, people who are on the left of this and who want, you know, who call everybody racist to ask any questions about our immigration will just turn a blind eye to the appalling conditions they're putting people in.
Yeah.
They'll pretend like, so I'll get to the question of whether or not he's eligible or should be here at all in a second, but just even let's suppose he's from a situation where he is fully legitimately here. He's still going to be in the tent regardless.
True.
And so somebody who is arriving in Ireland, a legitimate refugee, a person who is seeking our help, has arrived here, a person who would qualify under EU regulations in terms of qualifying as an asylum seeker under the law, is still being put on in a tent amongst drug deals beside a Portaloo on Mount Street in Dublin too. And I think that is shameful.
Well, now, I think very few people would disagree.
Well, no, but I think very few people would disagree with me privately, John, but I think a lot of people would just ignore that as an issue because it doesn't suit them. Do you know what I mean? Because they want to say, as I've used the analogy before, like myself and Keith saying that we're going to foster 15 children and aren't we so wonderful and everybody tells us we're kind-hearted people we are, that they would, but we're going to put them in tents in our garden. we don't have enough bedrooms for them. This is the same thing. It's treating people really poorly for your, but pretending like that's not happening while you act all righteous and morally superior to everyone else who asks questions about it.
Yeah.
Now, the other issue is that the time, and we know this from Helen McEntee's interview, that the procedure and the processing of this takes too long. And even when the process is complete and the person has been identified as not qualifying under the criteria for refugees, which is a strict legal criteria. It's not a thing that somebody sits down and kind of goes, oh, I wonder, what do you qualify? There's a very specific legal criteria for whether you qualify for leave to remain, asylum, or whatever it is. And so, or as a refugee. So if you don't, that's where our system comes a cropper, because even when you don't qualify, you then have all these appeal processes goes on and on and on. That guy, like you're talking about, and others like him, will be there not for weeks, but for months. waiting.
The Portaloos suggest longer. I mean, as I say, I mean, the government's policy appears to be that this is a sort of at least semi-permanent shantytown in the middle of Dublin, which is just, I mean, you don't have to be a genius to see that, you know, when you've got people living in tents in those conditions with no income, no sanitary facilities, by which I mean sort of showered baths, personal hygiene facilities, you know, a toilet is the bare minimum. I mean, you know, you also need somewhere to wash yourself, wash your clothes, all that sort of stuff. It's going to have massive impacts in terms of the ambience, environment, behavior levels in that part of the city. Now, that's the government's policy. It is astonishing. Yeah. I have to be, as I say, I don't favor candidates here, but I'm objectively astonished that party political support for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil remains at around 35% between the two of them, according to the weekend poll.
Yeah, but those, I mean, look, I don't know about polls anymore, because I mean, I think that there can be massive shifts in the way people think, but those last referendums, I mean, what were those polls? Do you think that those polls were wrong, or do you think people like actively engaged with the question in the last week and just changed their minds?
Very hard to say. I think more the latter than the former. I don't think pollsters go out to get it wrong. I think that, you know, and I know a couple of pollsters, like the people behind Ireland Thinks, for example, who do opinion polling for the Journal and the Irish Independent, they're very diligent people. Richard Colwell at Red Sea have been doing polls and got most general elections broadly right for the last 10 years or so. So I don't think they set out to get it wrong. I do think at the moment, though, because we've had all this sort of talk about, you know, the far right and extremism and all the rest of it, it's sort of been drilled into people that, like, you don't want to admit to being one of those people. So I do think there is the potential for, there to be a hidden vote that the pollsters aren't picking up. But that will also depend on the quality of candidates. I mean, without going back into your new job, one of the things that strikes me about the European elections in particular is that this is the first time really where there are...
choice.
I'm going to have to be careful about the word I use because I don't know people. But I'm going to say credible and then define it. There are credible alternatives. And by credible alternatives, I mean people who are well known, who it's very difficult to paint as extremists. The campaign you're running is one such example. There's also Padraig Tobin, obviously, who's running for AIN2 in Ireland Northwest. Very hard to paint Padraig Tobin as some kind of extremist. He's anything but. There's also Michael McNamara, who's just jumped in the race in Ireland South. Very hard to paint Michael McNamara as an extremist or somehow not representative of the public. So there are three examples. There are more. I'm not saying that every other candidate running is not viable. Credible. Yeah, I'm just pointing to those as three prominent examples of candidates who can carry that message in a way that, you know, you're not having to go and look on the ballot paper for some guy who you'd never heard of until polling day and then kind of like frantically research and Google him. You know, you, as a voter, you now have options. So I think the European elections will be very interesting, and they will either be, the results will be telling either way. I think the performance of those three candidates in particular will be interesting to watch. Mm-hmm. Anyway, can we talk a little bit about something else that happened this week, which was Roderick O'Gorman Gate? the protests at his house.
Gate being the operative word.
Literal Roderick O'Gorman's gate getting protested. And it produced the usual sort of fainting fits that we see in the media in particular, about this is basically the end of civilization. And I mean, as I said on social media, if you follow me during the week, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of it because, you know, Roderick O'Gorman ran for election. He put his hand up and said, I want this job. If you think he's doing a bad job, fair enough, hold him to account. But his neighbors didn't do that. And his I don't know what his domestic situation is, but for argument's sake, his partner, his children, his dogs, his cats, his parents who might be living with him, I don't know. They didn't do any of those things. And I think it's kind of unfair to target them. But that said, I also think the reaction is just a little teeny little bit hysterical. Am I wrong?
I think that the reaction is hysterical because people will ham it up because it suits them. But I don't think, I think that there's just, I don't like it. My father was a politician. I grew up in a political house. I think going to people's homes is just should be beneath us. It's not necessary. It doesn't do anything. You know, the you can protest outside the door. And well, I think that people, there was a lot of pearl clutching because it suited them. And I'm inclined, you know, I would caveat that by saying that there just wouldn't be the same hysteria if that was done outside the home of Maria Steen or, you know, somebody that they did, the mainstream media didn't agree with. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But ultimately, I just think nobody should do it. I think it's not necessary and we can protest elsewhere. And it's just not nice.
That's broadly my view as well. But like, I have to say, is this just sort of... some people have said things to me, like, you know, when I bring this up, and I get in trouble with my readers, because I got in trouble with my readers a couple of weeks ago because I said that a particular local election candidate who went into a cafe in his area and started giving out about the connections the owner allegedly had, in his view, to accommodation centres for migrants. I said, look, that's not on. Like, that's, you know, just turning people off. And it's, you know, and I got attacked. People said, oh, you're, you know, people are desperate. They have no other options. They need to have their voices heard, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, I understand that. But at the same time, you know, you can have your voice heard, but no one's, I mean, I compare this to sort of the Extinction Rebellion people. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, they have their voices. Last year at the Crucible, the World Snooker Championship, they went out and poured orange powder on the table. Do you remember that? And then they attack paintings in art galleries, and I think there was an incident where they tried to ruin the pitch ahead of an Ashes test match in England, and they do all this sort of stuff.
Anything but do a bit of work. Go on,
I think to myself, I mean, I'm looking at it from the perspective, I mean, does that make you like them more?
I love when they block the road and there's like an ambulance, you know, or something, like a woman in labor in a car, you know, it's five cars down and they won't let it pass. Brilliant.
Yeah, and it is at once true to say, there are two things that are true. Like, first of all, you can say, well, the media doesn't go after them the way it goes after us. That is true.
Yeah.
And so, but that doesn't mean you should copy their tactics, because that doesn't mean their tactics are effective. I mean, you know, if you're somebody who's, and this is something that like happened to Dublin Airport last year, who is, for example, flying drones over the runway to stop the planes taking off, that doesn't make the public turn around and go, I mean, the media might be like, oh, climate change protesters, and not condemn them particularly, but that doesn't make the general public think, oh yeah, actually, I never thought about it that way. Maybe I will kind of cancel my holiday to Magaluf or wherever I'm going. It's counterproductive in that sense. So, I mean, yeah, I've complicated thoughts on that. But I mean, to be honest with you, I find that the double standards so wearing that I kind of find it hard to get annoyed about it anymore. Because like the fainting fits, I mean, it almost comes across, there are some people in the media who are delighted that there are protests outside Roderick O'Gorman's house because they can talk once again about the dangers of extremism rather than the actual problems facing the country.
Well, this is exactly it. And do you know what doesn't get talked about when you're outside Roderick O'Gorman's house? Any of the things that Roderick O'Gorman has done wrong, and in his brief, and the things that he's messed up, and the stupid stuff that he's done as a minister, et cetera, et cetera. Not one of those things got discussed this week, because all that was discussed was the fact that you're protesting outside his house. So maybe don't.
Yep. Well, look, those are our views on that question. What else did we say we'd talk about?
Fine Gael have a new policy about children's mobile phones. So, you know, that's good.
Oh, is this the one where they're calling on the government to do something?
Yeah. It's my I've said it before in the podcast. It's my favorite thing when politicians who are in government call for things. It's like the equivalent of me sitting in my kitchen this evening and going, I call for spaghetti bolognese for dinner. And the kids looking at me like, yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things. It's one thing, though, when like a backbench TD does it. You can kind of understand that, you know, if some backbench TD in the government.
No, I still don't. But okay, well, I'll okay.
But a backbench TD is a very limited amount of power. So this wasn't a backbench TD. This is the Fine Gael party from their Fine Gael social media accounts. Fine Gael is calling for the digital age of consent to be enforced and better education on the impact of social media. Well, gee, who could do that, Sarah? I mean, digital age of consent.
Somebody do this?
That sounds to me like a Department of Justice issue, doesn't it? I mean, Fine Gael should really get on to whoever's running the Department of Justice and call on them to do that. I mean, for heaven's sake. I mean, I don't know whether that is more depressing or the fact that there are people out there who'd buy it. Anyway, let's talk about the policy, which is they don't want children having smartphones. I mean, are you in favor of that?
I mean, like, I'm totally in favor of kids not having smartphones, you know, partly, and my kids won't have smartphones until they're older, you know, ironically enough, partly to keep my kids away from the abundance of an ideology that Fine Gael are in favor of all over the internet, but that's a whole other show, as they say. But of course I'm in favor of that, but like, this so unbelievably transparency a nonsense announcement because there's elections coming.
Yeah. I mean, I got another email this week, and I must get, I'd say, a couple of hundred emails a week on various things. And if you're one of those people who emails me and I don't reply, the reason is I just don't have time to reply to them all. So I'm sorry about that. But every now and again, I get a mad one. And you know, this week's mad one was from somebody who was on about microchipping. He was, you know, it's of a plan that's going to be enacted, and you know, after the elections, they're going to forcibly microchip us all. And I was thinking about this, and I was like, well, why do people believe this stuff? And I was tempted to write back to him and go, why would any world government bother rounding people up and sticking microchips in them when the public have voluntarily microchipped themselves? Because it strikes me that, like, you're already microchipped. You've got a smartphone in your pocket. Your smartphone knows everything about you, from the books you like to your pornography viewing habits, to your friends, to where you went on holiday. It tracks your location, does all those things. And like, not only do we put them in our pockets ourselves, we give them to our kids, which strikes me as like, you know, takes the sting out of the whole microchipping thing. I remember reading a story like last year. About I can't remember which UK supermarket chain it is, but one of them, because of the loyalty card program where they track people's purchases, is able to know when a woman is pregnant, oftentimes before the woman is pregnant herself, because she has so much data on what she's buying each week. So oftentimes they'll be able to know, oh well, she's, you know, she's suddenly buying X, Y, and Z. Must be pregnant, and can actually tailor their ads to that person based on information that granular. So I mean, I don't think people have really come to terms with the import of the sort of technological revolution in their pockets. I think those people who are talking about, oh, the government is going to microchip us, I mean, you're 40 years behind the time there, lads, because they don't have to do it anymore.
Yeah, I mean, but I suppose I don't want my kids to have, like, when I think about it, like, I won't have my kids having mobile phones or whatever, but that's, you know, my personal choice. But at a government level, I don't know. I mean, there are people that I know who, you know, the parents are separated, for example, and it suits them very much for their child to have a phone so that they can stay in touch with that child. You know, there's different things. I mean, ultimately, I think it's down to the parents individually. I just think it's fascinating that Fine Gael would, you know, get their party out, make a kind of a slick video about it, you know, call for this, call for that. And like, ultimately put time and effort and energy into something like this when there are, you know, other problems, bigger problems it's not really any of their business how parents parent their children. And, you know, meanwhile, their Minister for Justice is getting absolutely filleted on a video that's going viral across the country. But this is what they want to spend their time on. I don't know. It's a bit tone deaf, really, isn't it?
It is. It's very strange. So, yeah, I got canvassed during the week. Did I tell you?
No, go.
First time. I've lived here in, you know, for 8 years now. First time I got canvassed. It was a lovely, actually lovely woman, the local Labour Party councillor, who, to be fair to her, rang the doorbell, walked up and had a chat and asked for a vote. And I told her straight out she wouldn't be getting one. Now, I did also tell her, and this is true, that because she was the first candidate to canvass me in years, and because she's a local councillor who, by all
accounts, you were going to give her your 19th preference. Go on.
No, I told her I'd give her a reasonably high preference, and I will, because it's a local electoral area where I think the last election were 4 seats and only 6 candidates. So, I mean, I don't know. And most of them are independents. And she did come and knock on my door, and I think that matters.
Does she know that you're the editor of Gripped?
If she recognized me, her face did not betray it. I mean, she has no reason to. Why would she?
I'm curious, what did you give her a reason for why you would not be voting for her?
Yes, I did. I said that I was going to vote for one of the independent candidates on the basis that I wanted to send the government a protest message in relation to immigration policy, law and order, and sort of the carbon taxes and all that sort of stuff. She nodded. I basically said to her, look, all the things you're for, I'm again, except without saying that directly. But also, I mean, I read her leaflet and she's got some stuff about playgrounds and all the work that's happening in the locality. And I think it is important to some extent to divorce local government from national government in terms of, you know, North Tipperary County Council, or indeed Tipperary County Council, whatever it is after the new boundaries come in, is not necessarily responsible for immigration policy. But yeah. I also think your vote is the one chance you have to express your voice in an election. So it's very important to do so. Anyway, no other candidate has knocked on my door yet. If that changes, I'll let you know.
Yeah, I haven't had any yet, but
Well, I suspect this lady was in accordance to what you might be advising candidates to do in your new role. She was getting the awkward bits of the constituency out of the way first. So I live in quite a rural area, so I presume that was the idea, so that closer to the election, she has more time to go to the vote-intensive housing estate, so you can meet a whole lot of people a whole lot quicker.
Well, look, fair play to her, but I don't think it will come as a screaming shock to anybody that Labour won't be high on my... I mean, we've discussed this before, but you have this bizarre kind of like affection for your vote where you take it really seriously, as in like your ninth preference this and your ninth preference that. And I obviously don't.
I wrote an article about this week. I don't know if you read it, about like how to use your vote. And I don't know if my bizarre affection came through, but I just think it's strategic. It's the important thing to do, because I always say, like, there are four council seats in my local area. I mean, if the guy I vote for gets elected, great. But like some say, 3 people I disagree with are going to get elected, or 3 people I don't vote number one for are going to get elected. So I want to have some say in who that is.
No, I know, but I would be like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4 maybe. But you go all the way. Like,
oh, I go the whole way, yeah.
I would not. I will be leaving Labour, Greens, blank.
I went to, I remember I voted at the, you know, the first election I went to vote in, where my wife and I went as a couple to vote. And she literally said she's never going to vote with me again. Because she's like, she didn't mark her ballot paper and I was still there like 5 minutes later. Like, what the F are you at? I was like, well, I'm not really sure who to put 13 and 14, you know. Tough decision.
Well, that's what I mean. You're gassed. Like, you take it like like so seriously. And then also you do this really Irish thing, which is like, you know, oh, I gave that person a vote. Yeah, but you kind of didn't, John, if it was 13. Like,
No, I refuse to do that. No, if I tell somebody, I mean, I'm not going to tell somebody.
No, but you say a vote as if, like, do you consider, if you give somebody a ninth preference, do you consider that to be a vote?
No. No, I would only consider it a vote if it was like a high preference, like in the top.
I only consider it to be a vote if it's warm.
Okay. But I would always tell them, and I want to be clear, like, I would always tell them if they ask me at the doorsteps that, you know, I'll give you a high preference, but it won't be a number one.
But do you tell people that you're going to give them a low preference? Like,
well, then I would just say nothing. I would just say nothing. No, I mean, I'd say thank you very much for coming and, you know, best of luck, et cetera, et cetera. Because I don't want to be mean to somebody. Oh, but this time, if a Fine Gael or a Fianna Fáil or a Green candidate knocks on my door, I will be telling them exactly why I'm not voting for them, because they're in government. And I think it's important.
Well, that's the thing that's changed for me a bit, in that when, you know, I'll be saying why more often, because I think in the past, politicians across all parties have, you know, had a pretty good gauge of why people are voting for them and why people are not voting for them. And I think that has gone a bit. And so if a Fine Gael, for example, or a Fianna Fáil or a Labour person or whatever, Green, obviously, because they're in government, knocks on the door, I won't just be saying no. I'll be saying no, and here's why. And it's because of, you know, your lack of any kind of plan or work on immigration, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Depending on what party, it'll be different. Obviously, Labour, you know, and Sinn Féin. I mean, Sinn Féin are the worst of all. I mean, I don't think they're going to knock on my door in Malloy. They never really seem to come into Malloy. But if they did, I'd be telling them that I'm most disappointed of all with Sinn Féin. Because I think that I know I don't deserve it in the fact that I never voted for them, but I think they owe the Irish public opposition, and I think they failed us massively. So I used to just kind of go, oh yeah, thanks and whatever, but this time I'll be saying why. Because I think that communication, that feedback loop with politicians is lacking massively, and I'm not going to let them away with not telling them why anymore. But I certainly won't be saying I'll give you a high preference if I'm giving them number 7.
Well, they know where your vote's going anyway now, because you publicly declared it. So,
but that's only one election. There's also local elections. Now I have people that I'm very friendly with running in that, so that's kind of a different thing. But in general, for canvassers, I was never going to vote for Sinn Féin, for example. But I'll be explaining in detail why this time. I doubt they'll knock on my door. They never do. Sad.
All right. So, well, just some housekeeping before we go. You can catch me this weekend if you're fond of saying hello. I'll be speaking at the Countess event in the RDS. I was described by Rosa Socialist Feminist, the Ruth Coppinger's group. They're holding a protest at my speaking at that event on the grounds that I am a far right hate monger. So if you're listening to me, I hope you too have been turned into a far right hate monger and recognize the absolute filth that you're listening to, and apologize to Ruth Coppinger. But that is on Saturday.
Ruth Coppinger, who's she again?
She was once the Socialist Party TD for Dublin West before she lost her seat.
But she's not anymore, so now she just goes and protests outside events for women.
Yes.
Great.
But if you're there and you feel like being labeled a far right hate monger by virtue of your attendance, that is on Saturday in the RDS, starting at, I think, 12:30. I'll be on sometime before 2 o'clock, because then I've got
another way of looking at it is that it's a really interesting event that has loads of really interesting speakers to talk about how women's spaces and women's rights are being taken over by the trans ideology. But, you know,
I thought the bit about me being a far right hate monger and being protested was more interesting personally, because I am the main character.
It was a bigger draw. Yeah.
But no, Sarah is also right. It is also an interesting event with many other good speakers. If you don't just want to hear me, although I don't personally understand why that would be, but there are other excellent speakers there. So that's where I will be at the weekend. Sarah presumably will be beavering away in some campaign headquarters somewhere, plotting how she can change the course of electoral history in Dublin. And we all wish her a reasonable amount of good luck in doing that. While obviously not endorsing any campaign that she may be involved with. I should say, by the way, that in terms of the Dublin European elections as well, Niall Boylan Aintu did launch a candidate this week, Aisling Considine, who is contesting that election, and Malachy Steenson, who is the representative of the East Wall protest group, also announced that he will be running. There are various others as well. If you're interested in sort of alternative candidates, I presume at some stage on Gripped we'll do a sort of who's who of who is running and what their positions are, from ranging from the mainstream parties to the lad you've never heard of. But that will all take place over the next couple of weeks. Until next week, though, Sarah, do you have any farewells you wish to make or any points we didn't raise?
No, not for now.
Well, then on that happy note, until next week, that was another edition of The Week That Really Was. Sarah and I will speak to you next week. I just want to say for the record that we got complaints about my audio last week. I hope it was better this week. In the event that it wasn't, we have a new microphone coming, winging its way towards us. So that problem should be solved soon. And thank you for putting up with it. But until then, adieu, and we will talk soon.